Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pole Position on Rock Sport Radio. It's Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd. We're broadcasting live on DAB Digital Radio across Central Scotland on TuneIn and online, talking motorsport from 8 till 9. So, on the show this week, Albon in, Gasly out, as Red Bull shake it all about. Dovi's dream comes true after win number 2, and we talk all things rally with David Halley. All this and more on Pole Position. So, the big news in Formula 1 this week comes from Red Bull, with Pierre Gasly being swapped with Toro Rosso's Alex Albon for the rest of the season. Now, Gasly has struggled since joining Red Bull this year, and Adam, a lot of people felt that this was a move that just had to be done.
Yeah, it was a matter of when, not if. Red Bull kept on saying they would keep Pierre Gasly to the end of the season, but if we're being brutally honest, it's probably better for Pierre Gasly that he has been demoted, because there was just no signs at all that he is improving in that Red Bull. He's up against Max Verstappen, who's, in my opinion, the best driver in the grid at the moment. And, you know, it was just damaging for Gasly. I think it's going to be a very tough weekend in Belgium. He's going to face a lot of questions from the media, but I think after that, going back to Toro Rosso might actually help him in the long run.
Now, Red Bull did say before the summer break that Gasly would stay with the team until the end of the season. So what's changed? Well, joining us on Pole Position to talk more about this is Steve Camp from Motorsport Week. Steve, why do you think Red Bull have gone back on their word here?
It's a bit of a misnomer. Gasly is technically still staying within the Red Bull team, as in within the Red Bull framework. I think that was possibly the hint behind it, and, you know, good PR speak from Red Bull. But personally, I think that this was a move that was probably always going to be on the cards.
And do you think there's a chance that this could finish Gasly off here in some respect, Steve? Because he's been low on confidence as it is. He then makes this demotion back to his former team. I just wonder if we'll see him on the grid at all in 2020.
Well, that's just going to be down to him. It's, at the end of the day, it's, you know, these drivers have got the best equipment around them, the best teams, and it all boils down to their own abilities behind the wheel. And if he hasn't felt that he can adapt to what's required from himself to get the best out of the car, then maybe Red Bull have felt that that was the best decision, and then giving Alex a run at the seat for the rest of the year to sort of get data gathering exercise on everybody is probably the best way to go about it.
Hi, Steve. Adam here. Why do you think they've gone for Alex Albon instead of Daniel Kvyat? Because Kvyat, of course, has experience at Red Bull. In 2015, he scored more points than Daniel Ricciardo. So you know what you're going to get from him.
And I think that's one of the reasons why they've kept him at Toro Rosso, which is might sound a bit backwards, but he got the podium for them in Germany. He's matured a lot since his previous attempts at Formula 1. I think Red Bull have recognised that, and I think that they want to keep that consistency going within Toro Rosso, especially if they're going to perhaps maybe score more points towards the end of the year and could elevate them in the Constructors' Championship from that perspective. We're giving Alex the seat at Red Bull, gives them the eyes and ears from his perspective to see how well he can do in that seat. They know how well Daniel can do. He's, you know, done the Red Bull drive. He's done testing for them. He did a year at Ferrari. So they've got enough data on him to know what he's all about, and we'll have seen how well he's matured and grown through that. So giving Alex the seat at Red Bull would be a chance for Alex to have a run at the car and see how well he can adapt to what the car needs, and if he's worthy of maybe matching Verstappen next year if they do it. So,
I mean, this is a huge gamble that Red Bull have taken, because it will probably take him a few races at least to get used to the car. Firstly, he's up against Max Verstappen, as we've mentioned. I mean, history could easily repeat itself, and Albon could easily find himself come Abu Dhabi in the exact same position as Pierre Gasly.
I don't think Red Bull have much to lose in that respect. They know that, I think, Gasly has been finding it more difficult to match Verstappen. I mean, his qualifying average compared to his teammate is the worst on the grid at, you know, on average over half a second. And that's you know, from anybody's perspective in Formula One, you could probably say that that's almost unacceptable to be so far off of your teammate. It's not something that you need. You know, Gasly was lapped by Verstappen in the two races that he won, and that says a huge amount. So if Red Bull are aiming for second in the Constructors' Championship, which looks to be the case, then they're going to need someone who can score a bit more points. If Albon is going to be more resilient and adaptable inside of the car and maybe get the best out of it, then he can perhaps maybe score more points, help them out, score Ferrari, and then, you know, they'll be happy and earn more millions by taking an extra place in the Constructors' Championship.
How much do you think Red Bull regret letting Carlos Sainz go, because he's had some great races this season at McLaren, only 5 points off Pierre Gasly in the Red Bull, and that's in a McLaren?
I think behind closed doors, it's definitely going to be something that Helmut Marko and Christian Horner might sit there and go, did we make the right choice in this? Should we have promoted Sainz earlier? And perhaps maybe they should have done, and I think that that will be something that they regret. Or, you know, did they regret maybe letting the air in Red Bull sort of go too far and allow Daniel to perhaps maybe leave at the end of last year and maybe think, oh, maybe we could have kept him on as well? And it's not helped now that the Red Bull Academy, excuse me, is looking a bit empty at the moment now, especially since they've dumped Dan Tickton.
And do you think Red Bull have maybe taken one eye off their academy and put too much focus on Max Verstappen? Because, you know, Verstappen's getting results when you don't expect him to, arguably outperforming the car, but there's been so much focus on Max Verstappen. And as you mentioned, you know, Red Bull, who have had one of the best academies in Formula One over recent years, the amount of talent they've brought in, all of a sudden, as you mentioned, it does seem that it's starting to dry up. They've been so focused on Max Verstappen, he's getting all the good results. And then they look at the other side of the garage and they're like, oh dear, you know, we're not scoring enough points here. We need another driver.
I think it's a bit of that and a bit of the fact that it got a bit too top-heavy too quickly. I mean, you had Verne come through. We had Daniel Ricciardo as well. You had Daniel Kvyat come through. You had Carlos Sainz come through. Max Verstappen, they signed on as well. And it all got too top-heavy too quickly. And I think that they lost a lot of drivers through that. Gasly sort of then came through, but then they held him back a year instead of putting him in the car, and then they sent him out to Japan before then bringing him back. They had Dan Tickton on retainer, and then he got a bit too verbal, I would probably use the word to describe it, and then I think they felt that they weren't going to have him in the team any longer, and, you know, have since sort of taken a step back in the academy. And I think that might be the right thing to do, because a lot of their drivers that they've got now, they might feel that they might want to keep for a couple of years.
Steve, I'm interested to get your thoughts on where you think Red Bull see the Toro Rosso entity within their hierarchy, because at the moment they're sitting fifth in the constructor standings. History's shown that they tend to be anywhere between 10th, they've had the occasional 7th finish over the last few years as well. If they have a strong sister team there in Toro Rosso, who's to say they can't just keep Kvyat there and he would be quite happy if he knew the car was competitive? And crucially, that would in turn allow their young drivers to show what they're really capable of, rather than maybe scrapping and getting the occasional 10th place finish or the odd good result based on a couple of cars ahead of them falling by the wayside.
It's certainly something for them to think about. I think with the midfield being how close it is, it's almost a lottery at the end of every race as to who's going to get those final points paying positions. Their dice roll in Germany has been a real coup for them, and it could have been Albon or Kvyat on the podium that day. And it really goes to show that if they get the car right on the right day with the right people behind them, they can get the right results. But whether it will be enough to keep their drivers on, I'd like to think so. I think Daniel is perhaps maybe keeping himself there, keeping himself in the spotlight, and maybe keeping perhaps one eye on everything else that goes on the grid, and maybe might snatch an opportunity elsewhere. But for now, I think he's happy with the seat that he's got at Toro Rosso, and then Red Bull are happy for him to stay there to keep the team on an even keel and in a consistent manner to make sure that they keep picking up the points.
And Steve, there's not a lot between Red Bull and Ferrari in the Constructors' Championship standings. Ferrari 288 points, Red Bull third on 244 points. But do you think that Red Bull can leapfrog Ferrari and take second place in the standings this year?
I would suggest it's more likely, yeah. It's going to be tough over the next two races. I think Spa and Monza are going to show up Ferrari's strength and perhaps maybe show that the Honda engine just still lacks that bit of extra horsepower against, you know, the Mercedes and Ferrari, and they might find themselves the third best team over the next two races. But, you know, when we go to Singapore, go to Russia, go to Japan, and then it could all change around, and then maybe Red Bull might find themselves back ahead of Ferrari. And I think if Albon gets through those races and finds himself he's getting more comfortable with the car, with his engineers, and can finally get the best out of himself and the car and do a better job than Gasly did behind the wheel, I wouldn't be surprised to see Red Bull and Ferrari go to Abu Dhabi and be within very few points of each other as to who can get second.
It's interesting what a difference 12 months makes as well, Steve, because when Red Bull announced that they were switching to Honda Power for 2019, a lot of raised eyebrows, to put it mildly. Yes, we knew the Honda package was making steps forward, but there was an element of surprise around it. But, you know, Max Verstappen, in my opinion, has certainly had his strongest season so far in Formula 1. And I think the key thing is, as well, he's pulled some sensational results out the bag, but he's been far more consistent with that car. But do you think expectations for Red Bull going into 2020, irrespective of what their driver lineup is, they'll be looking to say, right, we want second place at an absolute minimum, because the last couple of years under Renault Power have been somewhat challenging for them?
It has, and I think Renault took that on board, and they've improved themselves quite a bit under the power unit area as well. And we can see that with how well McLaren are doing. And I think it goes to show that the differences between Honda, Renault, Ferrari and Mercedes have all closed up in recent years, and that having either power unit almost is irrelevant now. With regards to Red Bull and their performances, it's going to be tough. But they are, if they can find themselves with the very best car that they can get in Abu Dhabi, they'll be looking to go to Melbourne come March and be thinking, right, let's go winning races straight off the bat, because next year's regulations barely change at all, because everyone's looking to 2021. And with many people looking to 2021, you're not going to see many teams bring many major updates across the year. So it's going to be a case of everyone's going to be wanting to get their development done now for next year. So whoever, you know, comes out best in Abu Dhabi is going to go to Australia probably looking just as good.
And Steve, just finally, on Albon, what would you class as success for him when he makes his debut for Red Bull at the Belgian Grand Prix next month?
To be closer to Verstappen and score points. It's going to be as simple as that. Red Bull aren't going to worry about him winning races. If he does win a race, then that's going to be fantastic for them. It's going to be great PR. It's going to be great for Albon. It's going to certainly put a marker on the seat, and Albon's going to be sitting there thinking, well, I've won a race now, why not give me the seat? But if he can pick up more points for Red Bull than what Gasly has done on a regular basis over the next nine races, then I think then that will be a job well done, especially if they can take second place. And I think that will definitely help him secure the seat for next year, which will be a huge coup considering 18 months ago he didn't even have a racing seat anywhere.
Absolutely. Steve, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us here on the show.
Always a pleasure, thank you.
That's Steve Camp from Motorsport Week there. And stay with us as we talk about all things MotoGP up next on RockSport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on RockSport Radio.
Now, moving on to MotoGP, Marc Marquez will have to wait another year to win at every track on the MotoGP calendar after Ducati's Andrea Dovizioso denied him victory at the Austrian Grand Prix. Joining us to look back on the dramatic race is MotoGP reporter Neil Morrison. And Neil, thanks for joining us. That win for Ducati and Dovizioso couldn't have came at a better time for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely agreed. After the race before last weekend in the Czech Republic, the Marquez Honda juggernaut really showed no signs of abating, and it was approaching the point where it looked as though Marquez was genuinely unbeatable. He just had that much in hand over the rest of the opposition. We know that Austria is a very Ducati-friendly track. Won three of the previous races that we've had there since we returned to the Red Bull Ring in 2016. And at several points during the weekend and indeed the race, it looked as though Marquez might be able to actually break clear of Dovizioso. But well, the Ducati rider held his own, held his nerve, and did his very best for the last corner of the last lap. And it was a fantastic win, maybe the best win that we've seen Dovizioso have in MotoGP. And, well, wouldn't say it reignited the championship hopes. I mean, Marquez still has a considerable advantage in the championship. But, yeah, it was a much-needed shot in the arm, I think, for the series, because there have been a few dull races before then, and, yeah, that was pretty exciting.
And as you mentioned, Marquez has been incredible this year, still got a huge lead in the championship. Is this the best he's ever ridden in his life? Is it in the form of his career so far?
Yeah, I really think so, yeah. I mean, he's had some stunning seasons before. He's had dominant seasons before. Back in 2014, he won the first 10 races, won the most number of races in any year in MotoGP history. But I think this year, just for the fact that in such an even field, we basically have four manufacturers this year that can win races. There are probably five or six riders that are capable of winning races in particular weekends. And the fact that he's made them look kind of silly on several occasions. I can think about the Argentina, for example. He won the race there by more than 10 seconds, qualifying at the Czech Republic before last weekend's race in Austria. His pole position margin was 2.5 seconds, which is just extraordinary and unheard of in the sport. He is pushing the boundaries of what I think is possible in a motorcycle. And he's always like that. But, yeah, this year in particular, I mean, he's just making it look effortless. He hasn't finished further behind in second since Bernal last year, which was in August 2018. So each race that he finished since he was either first or second, he's just he's a freight train, he's a juggernaut. And it's close to impossible to stop him.
And the one big talking point this season has been Yamaha's uncompetitiveness at the front. You know, it looked at the start of this year as if they'd made some improvements and were a lot more competitive compared to last year, which was a miserable year. But this season's not going to plan. But are there signs that they have made small improvements since the summer break and are heading in the right direction?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there have been weekends this year where Yamaha has shown that, okay, they're not at the level of Honda or Ducati. They're not capable of fighting for the championship just yet. But considering where they were this time 12 months ago, I think they've made pretty substantial progress since then. There's been a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes as well. They've reorganized how the factories run in Japan. They've put some more responsibility in their European racing department, which I think is going to have some really positive effects. Maybe not necessarily this year, but looking ahead to next year, several years down the line. And they do have, well, one of the most exciting riders in MotoGP, in the entire Grand Prix paddock, actually, on their hands. They've got Fabio Quartararo, who scored a sensational third position at the Red Bull Ring. Really, he should not have been there. I don't think the bike is capable of being there, but he rode a completely faultless race, qualified in the front row, actually was leading the first couple of laps, and didn't put a foot wrong for the remaining laps. And, okay, he wasn't able to live with the pace of Dovizioso Marquez, who were fighting for the lead, fighting for the victory. Quartararo came home and he was a full 13 seconds faster than the quickest Yamaha at the same race a year ago. So I think that does show that, okay, they're not at the level to be fighting for the championship just yet, but they're on the right path.
And Neil, there's been a lot of rumours doing the rounds in the paddock last weekend regarding who'll ride where next year, with Jorge Lorenzo at the centre of it all. There's been a few developments. Jack Miller's keeping his ride at Pramac Ducati. Lorenzo's seeing out his Honda contract. Just tell us where we are at with this situation and the Jorge Lorenzo situation, because, of course, he's meant to be making his return at Silverstone.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, what you said is absolutely right. There wasn't supposed to be a kind of silly season where riders are changing seats at the end of 2019, because all of the factory riders have a 2-year contract which runs from 2019 to the end of 2020, and Lorenzo is one of them. However, his struggles have been so pronounced in the first part of the season that he's clearly been keeping a way out. And one of those ways out was to return to Ducati, which would have been a sensational kind of event, considering how he left there a year ago. And figures that are high up in Ducati management were actually considering bringing Lorenzo back into the fold at the expense of Jack Miller. That was revealed by Miller to us last Thursday, just prior to the Austrian Grand Prix. Not everyone at Ducati wanted it. No one in Miller's team, Pramac Racing, satellite Ducati team, wanted it. But some people high up in Ducati management structure felt that Lorenzo offered a better chance of winning the championship in MotoGP than Jack Miller. As it stands, that has passed. Miller's renewed for 2020. He'll stay there for another year. It looks as though Lorenzo won't have any other options but to stay at Honda. And if you ask me, it's not really been the cleverest move from Jorge, because he's going to be back, going back to a team at Silverstone, a team that has tried everything within their means to make him comfortable on the bike. They've listened to all of his requests and come up with some answers, and the results didn't improve. And then just going back into that team at Silverstone, knowing that he has to get some results on the track, otherwise, if he knows that he doesn't really want to be there. So it's not an ideal situation for either party, to be honest.
And one rider I'm interested to get your thoughts on, Neil, is Johan Zarco. He's ended his contract with KTM earlier at the end of the season. I mean, there's so much talk about KTM being competitive. They've invested a lot in that team. And Johan Zarco, I mean, when he first came onto the scene, he was tipped for great things in MotoGP, but that partnership just not worked out.
Yeah, I think it's a real shame, to be honest, because, Zarco, as you said, when he came into MotoGP in 2017, was an absolute sensation. He was a real breath of fresh air. The series was aggressive. It seemed like it was only a matter of time until he won the first race. But the KTM trick is just not worked out. Actually, went back after he announced that he was going to be leaving KTM at the end of this year, at 1 year prematurely. I went back and listened to some of his comments from when he first rode the bike at Valencia last November. And you could just tell from the very start he knew that it was going to be a difficult task. The way that the KTM demands to be ridden, it needs to really be wrestled. You need to be ridden aggressively, you have to brake it, you have to accelerate very aggressively. It tires you out physically. And the style that Zarco was used to, not just in the past 2 years when he was riding the Yamaha in MotoGP, but also when he was winning World Championships in Moto2, was to be silky smooth, very precise, not to wrestle about that much. And it's just, it seems, if you talk to people at KTM, there hasn't been a great deal of effort on his part to adapt his style. And I think Zarco went away over the summer break thinking that there was a very important test in the Czech Republic coming up at the start of August. KTM were going to be bringing some new parts to that test to help him feel a bit more comfortable. During that test, he completed 30 laps in the morning, and then basically from 1 p.m., when everyone else was out trying new parts, new settings, he stopped testing out, and you clearly can tell that at that moment he thought, nah, this isn't going to work. And he went to the factory KTM management, their home race, last weekend, and he said, look, I don't have a ride sort of for next year, but I would rather not be in this situation without a ride than, driving around finishing 12th, 13th every weekend like I am doing now.
Neil, thanks very much for joining us on the show. Always a pleasure to chat all things MotoGP with you.
Yeah, thanks very much. Anytime.
Neil Morrison there speaking to us here on RockSport Radio.
Now, Thruxton is the venue for this weekend's racing in the Porsche Carrera Cup GB. And let's look ahead to the action now by speaking to Pro-Am driver Esme Hockey, who joins us on the show. Esme, you're just 9 points away from the top of the Pro-Am standings. How are things going ahead of this weekend?
Yeah, obviously I was racing last weekend at Brands Hatch at my home race in W Series, and now busy. Just arrived at today, ready for tomorrow's free practice. Like you say, only 9 points away from the leader of Pro-Am at the minute. So halfway through the season, I think we've got some good things coming for the rest of this year in Porsche Carrera Cup, and I definitely think we can be fighting with a chance of winning the Pro-Am Championship this year.
And Esme, it's been a busy year for you so far, to say the least, but there's been a little bit of a gap between last time out in the Carrera Cup GB at Oulton Park and Thruxton this weekend. Just talk us through how you readjust to the car and get yourself settled in for action this weekend.
Yeah, for sure. Driving two totally different cars this year is tough, and obviously between Oulton Park and having my win in the Porsche Carrera Cup at Oulton Park, I've been in the Formula 3 car with W Series for a couple of weekends now. So again, trying to get my head round both cars, which are totally different to drive, totally different driving style. I've had to kind of take myself away from Brands Hatch pretty quick, because I've only had this week to kind of forget about how to drive a Formula 3 car and start watching videos on boards ready for Fraxham. I also go on a simulator as well, so it's always handy. Go up to Cranfield University and use their simulator. So that's kind of how I've dialed myself in for this weekend.
And Esme, you mentioned the action in the Carrera Cup at Alton Park last year, and you got your first class win there as well. How important was it to get that first victory on your belt in the series as we go into a vital part of the season here?
Yeah, for sure. For me, it was really important to get that first class win. I think we're always pushing ourselves as racing drivers to get that win. So, it means a lot to kind of get it. And once you do get it, it's one of those things that seems so hard and so far to kind of reach. But then when you finally do get that class win, it's almost like it's so much easier to reach and such an easier target. So this weekend is definitely going to be to kind of build on that and again have class qualify on pole position and then just go from there, really have a good start, a clean race, and hopefully we can have another class win.
And you've had I think 7 podium finishes in your class from 8 races so far as well. I mean, what would you say are the key differences that you feel you've had this year compared to 2018?
Yeah, 2018, I think being my first year in the Cup car, a big jump from obviously the Cayman GT4 Club Sport. And so last year was just a huge learning curve for me. I think as a racing driver and in motorsport, the only way you kind of learn is to make mistakes. So last year we did have some podiums and we definitely got on the podium and took some silverware home, which was great. But it's not been a success. It wasn't as successful as this year has been. And I think I learned so much last year. I learned everything through my mistakes and what I did wrong. And this year I've just been able to kind of go from last year and just have a really clean season so far.
Hi Esme, Adam here. You mentioned the W Series at Brands Hatch last weekend, the final round of the inaugural seasons. Great job in qualifying for yourself to get it in third race. It must have been frustrating for you, but plenty of positives to take away from the final round.
Yeah, definitely. Brands Hatch, my home circuit. I live only 10 minutes away, so it was a great time for me and great to have my fans and friends and family there supporting me. And W Series, again, like I said, with Porsche Carrera Cup 2018 is always about like making those mistakes and learning. So W Series this year, the first time ever driving a Formula 3 car, it was a year for me to kind of make those mistakes, learn a lot, and that's definitely what I have done. The first 5 races, the 5 tracks that I'd never been to, it was kind of learning the circuits and learning the car at the same time. So going to my home circuit was the first time I could really focus on the car and myself because I knew the circuit really well. So obviously that kind of helped me and was in my favour. But I think I really showed myself and everyone at W Series and my fans what I can really do and what I can do in a car once I kind of do all the learning. So, yeah, Brands Hatch 3rd in qualifying was absolutely amazing.
How would you describe the experience of W Series this season? You mentioned going to new tracks, going to different countries, and overall, how do you assess your performance?
I definitely think my performance was quite strong. Throughout the year, I was always qualifying inside the top 10, and then obviously I had the amazing qualifying at the end of the year, which really showed what performances I can kind of have for maybe next year if I'm back in the W Series. So overall, yeah, I think performances are really good, and it was a great opportunity. I never would have dreamt of driving a Formula 3 car, and so to be given the opportunity to drive a Formula 3 car all year and fully funded is just a lifetime opportunity. And to go around the world, across Europe, driving all these different tracks that I've never been to was just absolutely unbelievable. So I've had an amazing time with W Series and it's been so much fun.
And what was it like mentally making the transition to single-seater cars and adjusting to that? I'm guessing different braking zones, etc. must have been a challenge.
Yeah, definitely a challenge. And a challenge to kind of get yourself get your head around the downforce and the aerodynamics of the car, because, again, totally different to what I'm used to in GT cars and having always driven GT cars. But, yeah, an amazing piece of machinery. And to go around circuits and the speeds you can carry through corners that maybe you can't in a cup car. And I think Brands Hatch really made me realise the speeds of the Formula car, because that was one circuit I'd been to in both cars. So, yeah, it just kind of proves to you how quick the Formula 3 car is.
And will you be looking at doing the W Series next season? And if so, what are the processes? Will you have to go through the same intense qualifiers as you did at the start of this season?
I definitely would love to do W Series again next year. Obviously, with my race not going so well at Brands Hatch, I didn't automatically qualify for next year. So the process is quite simple for me, really. W Series have plenty of data on me from the whole season. Obviously, they'll be testing new female drivers for next year, but whether or not they get enough new blood in, will determine whether or not they'll want to take me back. So I think what I did in the last race really will prove to W Series what the potential is of me. So qualifying third and being third quickest in the race, I think will hopefully be good enough to bring me back next year. So we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, for me, it's a bit of a waiting game.
And overall, how beneficial do you think the W Series has been to help promote women in motorsport?
Honestly, I think W Series has really promoted women in motorsport, and I think it's been absolutely amazing. And I really think they have done exactly what they wanted to do, which was promote women in motorsport and get more females on board and interested in motorsport. An example of that would be Brands Hatch last weekend. I've never seen so many little girls coming to the race circuit. So I think they really have made it something, and us as role models. So I think we definitely had way more little girls coming to the race circuit to come and watch us. And yeah, we've definitely got more fans who are female now. So yeah, they've definitely done a great job of that.
And Esme, looking ahead to the racing at Thruxton this weekend, what do you think the secret is to a good lap around that track? Because it's a very fast circuit.
Thruxton's actually a circuit I've never been to. So I think I'll have to get some tips off a few people who have been here. But yeah, I've done a track walk tonight and I've seen the circuit, and it definitely looks like it's going to be a quick one. There's really fast flowing corners, and I think there's only one corner which you slow it down for, which is the last chicane. So yeah, it's going to be a really fun circuit, and I think moving on from the Formula 3 car last weekend, it's probably going to help me out with this ballsy circuit. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Esme, you mentioned the fact you did the track walk there. I'd be interested to know what sort of things both you and your team are looking for when you're walking around the circuit, because it's something that a lot of fans see on TV and what have you, but is there anything in particular that you're looking to identify that gives you an advantage when you get behind the wheel?
Yeah, definitely. Track walks are super important, and you see way more from a track walk than you do in a car, because obviously travelling so fast, you miss things quite easily. But when you go on a track walk, you can see the different colours of tarmac when you're walking, and you can see marker points where you might want to brake, what you might want to look out for when you get into your braking zone, and then also where all the marshal points are as well. Sometimes they can really help you. And Thruxton especially, the marker points are pretty much sat on the apex curves of a lot of corners here. So as it's quite undulated and a lot of the corners are blind, if you can look out for the marshal points and the marker boards there, then it helps you as a driver really position the car so that it's in the right place for when you want to get to the apex, and you know how much speed you can carry and where your braking points are going to be.
And finally, Esme, what's the best way for people to follow what you're up to in social media and what have you?
To follow me on what I'm up to, I'm on Instagram and Twitter with @Esme_Hawkey. And yeah, I post everything of what I'm up to with my racing and everything else.
Excellent, Esme. Thank you very much for joining us on the show and best of luck this weekend.
Thanks very much, guys. Great talking to you.
That's Esme Hockey there speaking to us on Pole Position. And if you're looking for the halftime report from the Rangers and Midtjylland game, it's currently 2-0 to Rangers, goals from Morelos and Ojo. That gives them a 6-2 lead on aggregate, just going into the second half there at Ibrox. All right, let's move on to the rally stage now. And there's not long to go until the next event of the World Rally Championship as they head to Germany for the 10th round of the season. But there's a little bit of controversy in the service park at the moment over the rear wings on some of the cars. So let's find out more in this story by speaking to rally expert David Halley, who joins us now. David, what's the situation here at the moment?
The FIA have issued a clarification on the design and size of the rear wings on the car. The cars have not been illegal in any shape or form. The cars are all presented to the FIA for homologation inspection prior to first competition. So these world cars have been in play since the beginning of 2017, and the FIA had approved the application and approved the cars up till this point. They have admitted almost that they have made a small error of judgment or measuring on the Toyotas particularly. I spoke to one of the engineers from another team recently, and they said that when they saw the Toyota, they thought, "Struth, that's a bit big," or words to that effect. And the wing is possibly out with what was originally thought by the FIA to be the right size. The FIA have issued this clarification notification, and the teams have until Turkey to make sure that they all comply with this clarification. So they're allowed to run as were in Germany coming up, but for Turkey they will need to have done something to make sure that everything is in line with what they originally envisaged for the... And remember, these were new regulations in 2017, so there was a little bit of poking and prodding and looking at the regulations to get the cars how everybody wanted them to be.
David, just how important is the modern aero on these cars?
Massively important. You look at the louvers on the rear arches. Everything is being done to promote downforce. Now, it's slightly different on a rally car compared to a racing car, where you, in a racing car you've got a relatively standard surface that you can generate the downforce from. On a rally car, the surface underneath is by anything but standard and smooth and regular. So the aero has to be generated in other ways, and the rear wing was the big step forward for the 2017 cars. And then to balance that, the extra aero on the front wings of the cars to get that, and the box wheel arches with all the venting in them. Yeah, there's a lot of work gone into aero on these new cars because they are that much more powerful than what came before.
And the dealer's cars, of course, look absolutely brilliant, but they also look very expensive.
Oh, horribly, horribly expensive. The aero kit on these cars, it's all carbon fibre, and it's a very expensive piece of kit. A rear wing on one of these cars in carbon fibre is five figures very easily.
So, David, how does the aero on a World Rally car compare to... not so much an R5, but maybe like an R2 car, because those cars look very, very different. They almost look a bit like a typical road car in some respects.
R2 is based on a standard steel body shell, no carbon allowed on R2 at all. On the R5, there is a fixed rear wing. If you look at every R5 car, the wings are all absolutely identical. That is a defined size and shape of wing that's used on an R5 car. The R5 aero, in terms of the front of the vehicle, very much just a standard front spoiler, front splitter arrangement to guide some of the air round rather than under. But the world car, it's got aero all over it, including that big wing, the winglets at the front, ducts here, there and everywhere, and obviously coming through the side of the car as well on a world car, cooling air coming in and ducting through into the brakes. Just, yeah, a massive aero car.
David, just before we take a look at the Scottish action, a number of the manufacturers have been out and about doing a bit of testing. Valtteri Bottas is among the names of those out and about before Germany. allegedly on the pace with Chris Meek, according to some reports. David, what do you make of this whole situation with Bottas? Is there a chance, perhaps towards the end of his career in Formula One, where he may be interested in doing a more formalised rally entry?
Potentially, yes. He did a rally in the winter in a Fiesta World car, and he did very well for his first time in a rally in a World car. They're not the easiest things to drive, and he managed to master it, and he did very, very well, and he's got the bug for it. He is Finnish, after all, which used to be the home of the World Rally Champions. There were a lot of Finnish champions in the past, and he just absolutely loves it, and he's a really nice guy as well. He's done a lot of testing over the year where he's had a chance and where cars are around. He's kind of made himself available to go and have a play, and he's enjoyed himself. So, yeah, we saw Kimi Raikkonen get involved in rallying during one of his breaks from Formula One. What's to say that Valtteri won't have a go himself? And as we know, his drive at Mercedes is under inspection at the moment, shall we say. He's just not performed to the level that he was earlier in the season. So potentially he could be looking for something to do next, as early as next year, though I suspect if he did leave Mercedes, there would be plenty of teams after him.
David, let's take a little look at the Grampian Forest Rally now, because Ewan Thorburn winning his third title last weekend, both him and Paul Beaton have just been fantastic this year.
They have, but Jock kept them very, very honest. Over the first couple of stages, Jock actually had an 11-second lead over Ewan. And, you know, Jock in the Subaru, a stand-in co-driver, although a very experienced co-driver. His normal co-driver, Cammy Fair, became a father a week before last, so he was not allowed to go out and play. And, yeah, Jock kept him very, very honest. But, yeah, third stage, he just managed to find something and went for it. He only had to finish in the top 10 to win the championship on this event, and there's still a round to go in the championships. He's had that much success. He's been that good. But, yeah, he decided to go for it and won the event and took the championship in style.
And, David, that second place finish for Jock Armstrong, 27 seconds down the road, I think that was just his second podium of the season as well, which seems a bit strange in some respects.
Well, he damaged the car in May, so he hasn't been out since May, so that was part of the story. But, yes, he's the Jock enjoys his rallying greatly. He's using a car that's nowhere near as developed as Ewan's Focus, and certainly nowhere close to the guys who are normally out in the R5s. A lot of the guys with the R5s decided not to go out and play, as we know Gary Pearson particularly, because they were out of the championship struggle, and these cars are quite expensive to run, so it's better to save their pennies until they can get a shot next year and try again.
And one crew that were out in the R5, of course, John Wink and Neil Shanks, rounding out the final step of the podium in a Hyundai i20. 1 minute 55 down the roads in the end, but a podium all the same.
A podium all the same, and they were in their own little battle with Bruce McCombie in his Focus, and it all ended with Bruce being slightly upside down at the end, allowing John Wink to take that third place. But they were having a great battle over that third place for the whole event.
And David, with Bruce Rowan, the Focus RS, it's a WRC spec car as well from 2002. What are the kind of the implications for that going forward? Because obviously it's a car that's it's 17 years old or so. Not too easy to get spares and things like that. What are the kind of ramifications for some of the drivers out there in some of the older cars?
The bodywork spares are not that much of a problem. They're the things that are relatively easy to come by. They're certainly not cheap, but they are easy to come by. The older world cars, where they're difficult to keep going, is some of the sensors and some of the electronic stuff is now out of date. It's a bit like your Spectrum ZX or whatever little computer you had when you were a lad. The electronics aren't there. The people who manufactured those electronics aren't necessarily supporting that product. What is it? Windows 2000 potentially or something. So, yeah, it's sensors and the likes that cause the problems on these cars.
And David, just finally, we've got the Ulster Rally to look forward to this weekend as well, of course. Craig Breen among over 100 drivers on the entry list for this one. What should we be keeping an eye out for there?
This is one of these slightly complicated rallies that they have in Ireland, because this is the Ulster Rally, but it's a round of the Irish Tarmac Championship, so all the Irish regulars are out there after their championship. It's a round of the British Championship, so Tom Cave and Matt Edwards are leading that particular championship. They'll be out there trying to do their best. It's a round of a regional Celtic FIA European Championship and historic championship. So there's a lot of different cars out there. And from the perspective of the British Championship, you don't necessarily have to watch the overall results. That I think the British Championship drivers will be watching each other and letting the Irish boys go and play their own game. With Craig Breen out there, finishing seventh in Finland a couple of weeks ago, and he could win the Irish Tarmac Championship this year just with his outings. He's really going for it, and he will be the man to keep an eye on.
Excellent stuff, David. Thank you very much, as always, for your time here on Pole Position.
Not at all. We'll do it again. Thank you.
That's rally expert David Halley there.
Let's find out the latest from the Scottish scene by getting the Superfast Scotch Roundup with Glenn Alcock.
Hi, good evening, guys, and hello to everybody who's listening. So, big news today, Dario Franchitti has announced that he will be racing at Goodwood Revival next month. This is something many people never expected to see after he retired in 2013 on medical grounds after his horrific crash with Takuma Sato at Houston in the IndyCar series. So, Dario is 4 times IndyCar champion, 3 times Indy 500 winner, a great ambassador for the sport. So, it's big, big news. He'll be competing in 2 races over the weekend, which takes place over the weekend of the 13th to 15th of September. And he'll be competing in a Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase and an EC Cobra. So the Duke of Richmond said it's a truly special event that driver of Dario Franchitti's calibre will make his competitive return with us at the Goodwood Revival. Dario has a special place in the affections of all British motorsport enthusiasts. The opportunity to see him in action on home soil here at Goodwood is something that will provide a highlight for many thousands of people throughout the weekend. And I'd echo that. Dario's a huge hero of mine and is an incredibly nice guy. And it's really going to be great to see him back out on track competing.
And Paul Diresta as well, also been out in action in the DTM.
Yeah, so talking about Dario, Paul's cousin. So DTM, Brands Hatch started from 4th place in race 1. He took the lead, however, he was deemed to have jumped the start, unfortunately, and he received a 5-second penalty, which wouldn't have mattered anyway, because unfortunately he never completed the race due to a mechanical issue. In race 2, he finished in 14th position. The BTCC is heading to Thruxton, so Rory Butcher will be looking for another victory after last time out at Snetterton. So make sure you support the Scots, and you've also got Aidan Moffat there competing in his new Infiniti Q50. Ross Wiley, he'll be on track at Silverstone driving in his Ferrari 488 GTB in the GT Cup, so we wish him all the best. And just closer to home, so last night, Scottish Motor Racing Club track night, and it was a great evening with a dry circuit where drivers got the opportunity to take passengers out on track. So that was family members, sponsors, team members, fans, potential drivers, all getting a taste of what it's like to drive around Knock Hill. Really, really good night, you know, really busy. So it was a great time at the moment to do that sort of thing for people, because there was some prospective drivers for the grid next year. And I think they're, you know, getting a wee feeling for whether or not they'd want to compete. This is an excellent time just now if you want to go and do an experience at Knock Hill, maybe take your ARDS test, get yourself, you know, all geared up for next year's season. I can't recommend it more. It's really exciting. It's good fun. And I think the best thing about it is probably the sort of social aspect with the other drivers and members of the club. But yeah, definitely, if you're thinking of getting involved in SMRC, you can get them on Facebook. You can get in touch with me at Superfast Scots, and I can give you a little bit of guidance on that. On the topic of SMRC as well, so there's a way round this weekend for Classics, so they're heading to Croft, and other news closer to home. So we've got the closing date for winning that very special limited edition Jim Clark Lotus Evora. It's fast approaching, so it'll be 2 weeks today, which is the 29th of August, which is the official opening of the new Jim Clark Motorsport Museum. And the winner of the Evora will be announced then. So for £20, you've still got a great chance of winning what's an incredible car to win.
And Glenn, just finally, I've not been lucky enough to be able to get down to the museum yet to see the new Jim Clark facility. Glenn, you've been there.
Yep.
You've been able to sample a bit of a flavour of it. Just describe what it's like for a visitor to go and experience.
Well, somebody described it last night who was talking to me at the motorsport, the track night, and they were saying it's like being invited into somebody's living room in the old place, and now it's like you can see the whole house. So it's at a much bigger facility with a lot more on show. I mean, the old Jim Clark room was really good, and it was a great... I'm glad I went and saw it when it was in its original guise, because, you know, that's where Ayrton Senna went and visited there and stuff. But it was very, very small for what it was trying to do. The new place is great. I mean, the trophy room is incredible just to see. And that's not everything, I believe. It's just to see the amount of stuff that Jim won is really something to behold. The technology they've got as well, so there's like a... It's almost like an iPad that sort of slides along. So instead of having loads of detail about the trophies on the cabinets, you just slide the little tablet across underneath, and it'll tell you all this information about the trophy. It'll give you maybe photos of the cars, video footage of the races and stuff. So it's really taking it, you know, into a kind of new era with the technology. Obviously, they've got a simulator there as well, which is good fun to have a go on, and you get to see a couple of Jim's cars, and they're going to alternate the cars regularly, so there will always be, you know, a reason to go back. If you buy a ticket at the moment, then that lasts for a year, so you can go back and, you know, see the new exhibits and stuff. So I think that's really, really good as well. But I definitely recommend everybody, you know, if you can get along, it's a great day out, lovely, you know, part of the country as well. So yeah, pop along and try and support it.
Excellent, Glenn. Thanks very much for your time here on Pole Position.
Thank you. Cheers.
That's the Superfast Scots Roundup there with Glenn Alcock. All right, now it's time for a little bit of this.
Final lap on Pole Position on Rock Sport Radio.
It's that time of the show, Adam, as you tell us six stories from the world of motorsport this week in just 60 seconds. Now, you got away with it last week, Mick. We kind of ran out of time to be perfectly honest. So,
blessing in disguise.
So we'll see how you get on this time round, Adam, as your time starts now.
Kimi Raikkonen's son Robin got his first taste of go-karting. Kimi shared a post on his Instagram of his four-year-old son behind the wheel of a kart with the caption, "Ace Man Begins." McLaren boss Zak Brown has admitted that Fernando Alonso has not shown an interest in racing full-time in IndyCar. It's after McLaren confirmed they would compete in the series full-time for the first time in 40 years, starting from next year. Sam Bird has lost his Ferrari seat in the World Endurance Championship with Miguel Molina replacing the Brit in the GTE Pro class. It's due to potential date clashes with Bird's Formula E programme. British Touring Car Championship driver Andrew Jordan has admitted he might be forced to leave the championship at the end of the year. It's after the 2013 champion lost his title sponsor Partec and has yet to find another source of funding. Jamie Chadwick became the inaugural champion of the all-female W Series. The Brit finished fourth at the season finale in Brands Hatch, which was good enough to finish top of the standings by 10 points. And finally, congratulations to Haas F1 driver Kevin Magnussen and his partner Louise Gorup, who got married recently. The pair have been together since 2015 and tied the knot in front of close friends and family in Denmark.
Oh, skin of your teeth.
Perfection, there we go.
Absolutely. And Adam, just a brief recap for the W Series finale there, where we had Esme Hockey on the show earlier, obviously. He was competing in the championship alongside her commitment in the Porsche Carrera Cup GB. Jamie, though, it was interesting reading her comments from it. She says it was one of the most stressful kind of experiences in her life in some respect, just because there was so much at stake.
Yes, definitely. And I have to say, it has been a huge success, the W Series. I mean, at the start of the year, you know, there's a lot of controversial pieces written on it, especially in the media. Is it good? Is it bad? But, I mean, the amount of media coverage it got, I mean, you know, in newspapers, and, you know, that read by millions of people, it was incredible. So it got a huge amount of coverage, which is great to see, and it's only going to build on that. So it was a terrific performance from Jamie Chadwick, and it'll be interesting to see now, as W Series champion, what's next for her.
Absolutely, and congratulations again to Jamie from all of us here at Pole Position. And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for on the show this week, but we'll be back from 8 o'clock next Thursday night to do it all again. My thanks to Adam, to our guests, and to you for joining us as well. Stay tuned for The Rock Zone, coming up next, right here on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.